This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. A new political era is underway in Europe in the face of two seismic snap elections. Today in France, people are casting ballots in the second round of voting that will chart a new course for the country's future. Across the channel, there was that landslide victory for the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, ending 14 years of conservative rule. The places, players, and public may be different, but voters in the UK and France seem to have one unifying message, that is change. Paul Waldy is the Globe and Mail's Europe correspondent. Sophie Petter is the Paris bureau chief for The Economist. And Amelia Hadfield is a politics professor at the University of Surrey and the founder of its Centre for Britain in Europe. Good morning. Hello to you all.
Good morning.
As I said, Hi, Paul. There are many different factors and forces behind these two elections. But Amelia, when we look at them side by side, do you see any kind of through line?
Yes, I think so. Both elections were called very speedily. In the UK, for Rishi Sunak, it was called to prevent even worse results and the complete destruction of the Conservative Party, and to try at that point to capitalize on small amounts of trade growth and investment. In France, of course, it was a stunning loss for Macron's party in the European Parliament elections. And seeing the triumph of the Rassemblement National take first place, which I think really, really shook him and bounced him into calling these snap elections. So you do have some very real similarities. And as you said at the beginning, both driven by a real sense of disenchantment and a profound need for change.
Okay, so Sophie, we saw in France, we're seeing this right-wing swing, at least in the first round. We saw that in the European election. But in contrast, the UK has chosen a centre-left party in Labour. So on the surface, you could look at these neighbouring countries and say, look, they're moving in different directions. But would that be an accurate assessment?
Yes, I think they are moving in different directions. What strikes me about the political cycles in France and the UK at the moment, and in fact, when you look back, it's often been the case, is how they're completely out of sync with each other. If you think back to the 1980s, when Britain was under Margaret Thatcher and bringing in an extremely liberal version of conservatism, that was when the French voted in the first socialist president, François Mitterrand, in 1981. And that is, I think, really, you know, ever since we've seen these cycles out of sync. And at the moment in the UK, my feeling is that we're coming to the end of the sort of fallout of Brexit. I mean, that was a vote in 2016. It shook up politics. It divided the nation. It brought in this period of chronic instability in the Conservative Party and some pretty chaotic government during that time. And at that moment, the French voted in a sort of centrist politician, Emmanuel Macron, who then was re-elected. So we've had quite a lot of stability of a sort in France at a time when Britain has been chaotic. So I think we're now, you know, the paths are crossing and we're heading in very, very different political directions.
And Paul, taken together, how are you seeing this puzzle of these two countries?
Yeah, I would disagree on that. I think the countries are more aligned than a lot of people think. I think what you need to keep in mind with the UK election is, on one level, yes, Starmer won a big majority in the House of Commons, but his vote, the Labour Party's vote, was only barely ahead of what they got in 2019. They got 34% of the vote and two-thirds of the seat. You know, it's kind of the nature of the first-past-the-post system, same in Canada. It throws up a lot of exaggerations. The third largest vote-getter was the Reform Party, which has only been around for 3 years. Now, they got more votes than the Liberal Democrats. The Liberal Democrats got 72 seats, Reform got 5. But they got 14% of the vote. And I think that's a reflection of a move in the UK toward, you know, anger, resentment, whatever you want to call it. But they voted a lot, an awful lot of people, ex-conservatives voted for Reform. You're seeing the same thing here in France with the rise in support for the Rassemblement National. And I was talking to Rassemblement National candidate yesterday, and he was pointing to the Reform Party saying, look, we take our lessons from them. Britain is going the same way we went. We've just gone a little bit further.
We'll talk more about reform a little bit later, but I want to focus on France for a bit because, of course, they're voting the final round of election today. Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party saw increased support in that first round of voting last week. And part of the reason that President Emmanuel Macron called this snap election was because of those June European parliamentary elections. He said calling the election in France for the National Assembly was, quote, a reasonable solution. Sophie, you've interviewed Emmanuel Macron. You've wrote an entire book about him. What is your sense of his decision-making style? Like, why did he make this move in such a manner, even taking his own inner circle by such surprise?
Look, I think the only person who really knows what goes on in his head is himself. And we've spent a lot of time trying to work out why he took this decision. It completely, it took even his closest allies by surprise. He only informed his prime minister, Gabriel Attal, at the last moment. It was an extremely unexpected decision. And I mean, there are only really sort of a couple of explanations for this. One is that he is someone who absolutely hates being forced into a situation. He doesn't like losing control. And he was facing, he runs a minority government or did. He was facing a potential no confidence motion that could have toppled his government in September when he presented the budget. And that rather than being forced into dissolving parliament, he decided to take the initiative and to do it at that time at his own calling when he wanted, and in the hope that that would leave the opposition parties in a sort of form of disarray and unable to get themselves together. Well, that if that was the calculation, it spectacularly backfired because the opposition got themselves together. But there is an alternative, and it's important to bear this in mind, is that, you know, that he was looking ahead to 2027 when the France has a presidential election. Now, if you think that the chances are very high that Marine Le Pen might have won or might win, there is an argument. It's a bit of a kind of, you know, complicated gamble as well. But there is an argument saying, why not let the French voters see what it really is like to have the far right in power and let them make a mess of it and then see if that doesn't diminish her chances of winning the presidency. Huh. Either way, it was a huge gamble.
Yeah, that's it's not about your next job. It's about the job after that and setting it up to as you say, to hopefully for Macron to come back well in the next couple of years. But the thing is, Paul, is that his popularity has been plummeting for some time. You said, look, I've been talking to people in Paris the last couple of days. So when you talk to people, what is your sense of why Emmanuel Macron is so disliked at this moment?
I think it's a reflection on incumbency. People get fed up with politicians, with governments, with leaders who've been in for a while. And Macron, of course, is into his second term. I think he's been a divisive figure for a while. A lot of people say he's got this kind of regal style of leadership that they don't like. I mean, I think he's getting blamed for some of the cost of living pressures here. There is a lot of focus on immigration here, as there is in the UK. Same issues in the UK as well with cost of living and Rishi Sunak having to wear a lot of those problems as well. By the way, nobody can understand why Rishi Sunak called the election either. So I think they have similarities on that front as well. But yeah, I just think that, you know, Macron is facing a real challenge here in getting out from under a legacy that people are blaming him for, whether it's economic, whether it's migration, whether it's a lot of other things. And there's just a backlash going on against incumbencies that I think you're seeing in a lot of places, even in the U.S. to some extent with Biden. So I just think this is a pattern that's going to continue, and it's going to be very difficult for the next candidate in the presidential election here from the Macron side. Macron can't run again, but whoever goes up against Marine Le Pen is going to face a lot of challenges.
Okay, so if you help me understand better the National Rally Party, which grew out of the National Front, an earlier iteration that was led by Marine Le Pen's father, Jean-Marie. So it's long been known for embracing anti-Semitism, anti-immigration sentiment. It's been described as racist and xenophobic. Given that history, kind of place that in the current moment we're seeing in France and how it's sort of selling that message.
Well, I think the best way to sort of understand how this party has changed under Marine Le Pen's leadership is to look at the images of her new crew of deputies who got elected in 2022. She had 18 of them that time. And they walked into parliament and they were all, on her instructions, wearing suits, wearing ties, the women in jackets, they were looking smart. It was a kind of a really visual effort to tell people these are serious politicians. We're a serious party. We are actually capable of governing. And that, I think, has stuck in people's minds. You know, it used to be that Jean-Marie Le Pen himself, he was never even invited into TV studios. I can remember the day when he would be sort of in a duplex situation in a corner of the screen because people wouldn't even have him in their presence. Marine Le Pen is now considered part of the landscape, and she's very much managed to present herself for all the kind of people that she's still surrounded with all the candidates that she's had to withdraw at the last minute because they've been, one of them was photographed wearing a Nazi officer's cap, for example. For all of that, she has managed to convince the French that the party is not her father's party. She's changed its name. It's for power. And that seems to have been bought by a lot of French voters, not a majority, I would say, of the French population, but a majority, but enough French voters to put her in a position to come top at the elections this evening.
Amelia, you study European Union relations. Is this moment in France a sort of watershed for Europe more broadly, do you think?
I think it's similar to the sorts of trends we saw throughout the lead to the European Parliament election. So the phenomenon of the far right in France that Sophie's explained is duplicated elsewhere. So there's sort of two forms. Either they're already holding power like Orban in Hungary, or recently held power like Poland, or continuing to hold power in the Czech and Slovak republics, or they've not yet holding power and they're interested in doing so. France is a great example, but so is Germany. I'd really be surprised if Chancellor Scholz is able to hold on much longer. We saw upticks also in places like Austria and, of course, Giorgia Meloni in Italy. And every one of these are different in terms of their ideology. So I think there is a question as to how they play together. Where they're going to sit in the European Parliament. We're still seeing quite a lot of horse trading as to whether they're going to work happily and coherently as a group in the ECR party. And I think the question, of course, is what that does to Europe as a whole. It was an interesting remark that Europe seems to be, you know, trending in one direction. I don't want to over-egg it too much. It's not as if they're falling off the far-right precipice. But at this point in time, now with a centre-left government, under Keir Starmer in the UK, it seems to have pressed the moderate button. And the idea, of course, is if it can ideologically counterbalance some of the far-right phenomenon that we're seeing in the European Union.
To that point, Paul, there are some concerns when we look at France that there may be a growing mood of Euroscepticism. How are you seeing the bigger European picture?
Well, I mean, there is to some extent, and I think, Sophie would probably know this better than I do, but the one thing that National Rally has really got going for it is this new leader they've got, Jordan Bardella, and he's this young kind of dynamic guy who's managed to transform the party to some extent, get this huge social media following. Now, they've kind of played down their Euroscepticism a little bit, although they want to cut their funding for the European Union. I don't think there's any move certainly on their part. They certainly don't talk about leaving the European Union or anything like that. But, you know, I think they don't want to play as much around with the EU and maybe even not as much with NATO. So I do think that's going to be an issue in France. And when you think about it, you know, this is the second biggest country in the European Union. That's going to be pretty dramatic if they do manage to get a majority today.
Sophie, how are you seeing France's relationship with Europe?
Well, it's an interesting one. I mean, Marine Le Pen has been on a bit of a journey with that. She used to call, I can remember her calling for Frexit after the British vote for Brexit in 2016. She called for Frexit. She even made a poster up with that slogan on it. And she used to then call for France to pull France out of the euro. So she has now she's ditched both of those policies. She's moved to something that sounds a bit more palatable and scares the French a little bit less. But, you know, there is an argument that she's now sort of disguising that Euroscepticism, because if you actually look at the policies and what she wants to do, she's a lot of them set herself on an absolute collision course with the European Union institutions, with partners, partner member states. I mean, take what Paul just mentioned, that's to say the promise to cut 2 or 3 billion off the French contribution to the European Union budget. Well, you know, France is a founding member of the European Union. It's the thought that France would go into a meeting and start saying, actually, we want our money back, sort of Thatcher style, is quite incredible. And again, you know, when you think through to what this could mean if there was the government in France under the National Rally, and still Macron is in the presidency, which he is entitled to do until 2027. The potential for conflict between an incredibly pro-European president and what would effectively be a Eurosceptic government is enormous.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with the Globe and Mail's Paul Waldie, the Economist Sophie Petter, and Amelia Hadfield from the University of Surrey about what elections in France and the UK may signal for Europe and the world. Amelia, let us shift to the UK. There has been much analysis of what went so right for Keir Starmer's Labour Party on Thursday and so wrong for Rishi Sunak's. So now that you've had a few days to sort of digest this result, what do you think? Why do you think things turned out the way they did?
Oh, gosh. It's such a short program. I don't know if I can do it justice. I mean, it's an omni-shambles, if I can call it that, for the Conservative Party. Not only was it a very poorly timed choice of an election, he absolutely didn't need to call it at that time. Sunak inherited a series of terrifically poor decisions and even more poorly implemented policies. Really from Brexit onwards, from Boris Johnson's government, which seemed utterly incapable of being able to clearly put to the House of Commons an understanding of what post-Brexit Britain looks like in regional policies, healthcare policies, education, and its relationship with Europe and the rest of the world. When he was turfed out of office and then put in Liz Truss, she worsened the problem still further. So this disastrous mini budget in 22, which absolutely crippled the country and suppressed absolutely everybody's ability to earn and to promote growth. And people are still laboring under, you know, dreadfully high rates, mortgage rates. I think that was it. And Sunak moved from the Treasury as a sort of quite competent chancellor in a management style, you know, sharp suits, management style, shuffles along from number 11 to number 10 and is just incapable of righting the ship. It was already in far too gone at that time. Set against that, you have an increasingly professionalized Labour Party with clear points of departure from the Conservatives. A very likable, if somewhat methodical, leader in Keir Starmer, and a sense that he's doing an enormous amount of preparation ahead of what's likely to be a Labour victory. Don't forget, we've seen the 20-point lead held by Labour for more than 2 years, which is really something. And he's managed to play and shift people's expectations and to be able to, you know, push the Labour Party into that vacuum and say, you know, continue to look at us and have faith in us, because I'm not just talking about change, I'm talking about growth. I'm not just talking about stability, I'm talking about reform. And it paid off.
Paul, I want to, you know, whenever I hear people talking about what's going on in Europe, I hear echoes of Canada, and I just want you to kind of assess that. So, you know, we just heard about the 20% lead in the polls that Labour has had for a number of years. We've just heard that Rishi Sunak, I think, was the fifth Conservative leader in 12 years. A number of predecessors had to exit. He's going to step down as party leader, so he will follow them. His Conservative Party had been losing support for months ahead of the election, as evidenced by some major by-election defeats. So when you look at Canada and you look at our parties and some of those similar themes, are we right to be drawing some parallels of what we're seeing here in our country?
Oh, for sure. I think there's definitely parallels between what happened in the UK and what could happen in Canada. As you mentioned, you know, Rishi Sunak, yes, he inherited a pretty bad hand. And, you know, the Conservatives in Britain managed to remarkably upset people who voted for Brexit and people who voted against Brexit at the same time, which was kind of the beginning of the end for them. But, you know, if you look at, you know, just politically what happened to him, you know, they started losing by-elections all over the place in ridings they never should have lost by-elections in, or any elections for that matter. Same thing you just saw in Toronto with the Liberal Party. That's a real red flag. That's a real warning sign. Again, you're running into a situation where the government's been in power for a while with a leader who's unpopular and with an opposition party that's resurgent and reinvigorated. And that's very difficult to overcome, because, you know, when people make up their mind that it's time for a change, it's very hard to shake that. And, you know, Sunak spent the entire campaign, as awful as it was for them, trying to say that he was the agent of change. And then he shifted gears and said, well, beware of them because they're going to be worse than me. And none of that worked. And I just don't know that there was anything they could do. Labor kind of held its lead. It fell a little bit on election day. And I think that was also a factor of people voting reform. You know, people saying, I don't like either of these two parties. I'm going to vote for this third place party. So I do think there's a lot of parallels there. And it's going to be very difficult for the Liberals to overcome it. They could go the road of the Conservatives in Britain, who have a history of just dumping leaders when they don't think they can win quite quickly. But that has proven to be ineffective for them as well. So it's going to be tough for them.
We'll talk more about the Liberals here at home in our next hour. But the other parallel, Paul, is about Reform UK. So its leader, Nigel Farage, won a seat for the first time after seven failed attempts. You talked about them. I think they got five seats. He has this reputation as a right-wing disruptor. He was a Brexit campaigner, a vocal Donald Trump supporter. And he has said, look, Reform UK sort of playbook came from the Canadian playbook for the Reform Party here many years ago. So what's the next step in this playbook with that Canadian analogy for Reform UK?
Well, he would like to see Reform UK do exactly what Reform Canada did back in the 90s, and that is effectively take over the Progressive Conservative Party, unite the right, and emerge as this new strong force on the right. Now, that was probably more manageable for Preston Manning because he had a geographic base to start from. You know, he won 50-odd seats in the 90s. They had a base in Western Canada. Reform UK doesn't really have a base. I mean, as I mentioned, they won five seats, but they got, you know, 4 million votes, you know, the third highest number of votes. So their vote total spread too far right now for them to wage any kind of a takeover of the Conservative Party. However, the Conservative Party now, as it descends into a leadership battle, has to figure out what it is. And it is going to go through this struggle of what they call one nation conservatives, which we would call red Tories, versus people on the further to the right, like Suella Braverman and Kemi Badenoch. Those people, in fact, openly talked about maybe courting some of the reform people, maybe kind of a unite the right type of scenario. It's going to be very difficult because Nigel Farage is a pretty big character. It's not likely he's going to want to join a party where he's a second string. So it's going to be harder for them to do in Britain what Reform managed to do sort of kind of in Canada, or at least get the process going. But that's what Nigel Farage wants to do. And he very much points to Preston Manning and the Reform Party of Canada as his inspiration.
Okay. It's an election year in many, many countries around the world. Most notably, of course, in the United States, as you all know, there are rumblings and calls for Joe Biden to step aside. Our election in Canada must be held by October of 2025. So let me just go around the table before I let all of you go. Amelia, are there lessons from the elections in France and the UK that leaders in North America should be taking away, should be heeding what they're seeing there?
Yes, I think so. Probably competence and complacence. I think that the Tory party allowed itself to fall apart because of incompetence and assuming that the voters didn't care and wouldn't punish them. So I think both of those are a problem, and they translate into sort of incapacity at the vote box. I think the other issue is probably watch out who's stealing your votes, if I could put it like this. So, you know, the Tories lost votes to Labour. They lost Liberal voters to Labour because Labour has appeared to be more professional in terms of their competence, in terms of their foreign policy, their relations with Europe, in terms of their managing of the economy, local government, and because they are more corporate minded, I think, in terms of public service. Starmer made it very clear. It's a privilege to be in government. And there's a sort of very cavalier approach, I think, that really has angered a lot of Brits over here with the role that Sunak, but particularly, I think, Boris Johnson took. And of course, the Tories lost, and Paul's quite right on this. They lost voters to the far right to reform because a big gap opened up on things like Brexit and immigration and climate change and tax. And of course, Canada doesn't have the Brexit issue, but there are very big, quite similar, quite parallel pressures. If those aren't answered coherently, if you don't have a policy that is implemented in a way where it makes the right sense materially for voters, they will turf you out of office. And we've seen very, very sharp reactions from in this sense, particularly from Britain.
Sophie, what are the lessons for leaders in other Western democracies, given what we've seen in the UK and are seeing in France?
Well, I think that one thing I would say for Keir Starmer as he now embarks on his sort of project of running the UK is, and this discussion is somewhat given the idea that the UK is a chaotic parliamentary system, system. Let's just not forget that he's won a landslide majority. He is going to be in a very strong place. He is going to be able to represent the UK as a serious partner for other countries around the world, as a real player on the global scene, as well as having a very sort of serious and earnest government in the UK. But I think that the lesson that France offers him, in a way, is that sometimes, you know, earnest, policy-driven government and even results that you can deliver from that are not enough if you don't get the politics right. And I think that that is what where Macron has been. He has actually done a lot to modernize France, to bring down unemployment, to create jobs. He has quite an interesting track record in that respect, but it's not enough if you don't get the politics right. And I think that, in a way, is the lesson for the UK from what's happened to Macron over the years and the
Right. Paul, what are you seeing as the lessons for Justin Trudeau, Joe Biden, other Western Democratic leader, given what we've seen in France and the UK?
Oh, I would say the big lesson is beware. I mean, there's so much volatility out there. I mean, look, we're talking about the UK. Yes, the Labour Party won a landslide in terms of seat, but their vote total barely changed in 5 years. And it could go out. They could lose that whole majority again 5 years from now. You know, they went from being a party on the verge of, you know, collapsing in 2019 to having this huge number of seats with basically the same number of votes. So, I mean, I think there's a real issue here in terms of these leaders listening to people outside their orbit, listening to people outside their comfort zone and picking up on the real undertones of what's going on out there.
It's been a pleasure listening to all three of you this morning, and I appreciate all of your analysis. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Paul Waldie is the Globe and Mail's Europe correspondent. He's in Paris today as that last round of voting in for the National Assembly takes place. Sophie Petter is the Paris bureau chief for The Economist. Amelia Hadfield is a politics professor at the University of Surrey and the founder of its Center for Britain in Europe. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.